Apologies for the ads. As an independent one-woman show, ads help me recover some of my costs. If you want to skip the ads, sign up to the exclusive feed. All episodes are free from ads, and there's full-length bonus episodes as well. The link is in the show notes. You can also make a one-time donation at buymeacoffee.com/amillionOTW. And on with the show, as they say.
Most tax pros leave a message.
It's Jane. I'm moving on to a TurboTax expert who beat your price. Adam Devine, tell him how I feel.
Hey, tax pro, she's been thinking twice. Best believe TurboTax will beat your price. This is a tax break.
Switch to a TurboTax Live expert and we'll beat what you paid your pro last tax season. Make the switch at TurboTax.com/beat your price. TurboTax full service only. Sign up by 12/20/2024 and file by 4/1/2025. Full details at TurboTax.com/beat your price.
This is A Million Other Choices, and I am, as always, your host, Kim. On October 12, 1987, a call to 911 came in from the Niagara Hotel on Vancouver's West Pender Street. West Pender is a street that I don't think I've ever been on, but if you are familiar with the area, you can tell us if the reviews on Reddit of the street are at all accurate. Incognito writes, "Honestly, if you're male, white, and big, it's not that bad. If you're not those things, though, brace for harassment of the physical, sexual, or racial variety. You'll be relatively safe. The addicts aren't that dangerous. Most couldn't find their own butthole if they farted. What won't be safe is your stuff. If it's not bolted down, it'll be stolen. Sometimes even if it's bolted down, it will be stolen. If it's nice, it'll be vandalized. If it's vacant, it'll be lived in. When it's done being lived in, it'll be shit in." Which brings me to my next points, noise and smell. I hope you're a heavy sleeper because often you'll be woken up by the crackhead mating call. Then in the morning, you'll play the game, is the poo I stepped on human or dog? Anyway, long story short, yes, you'll be safe, but you'll be irritated. Shut_front says, "The area is grungy, smells like piss, has a lot of crackheads, but personal safety-wise, it's nowhere near the level of St. James Town. You'll be fine. You won't get mugged like you would in Toronto. The people down here can barely stand up, let alone mug you. Having said that, get yourself a can of pepper spray, $20 at the Army Surplus Store on Granville Street. The crackheads mind their own business. It's loud, and you'll be absolutely shocked at what people are allowed to get away with. Then it'll all make sense to you why Vancouver is referred to as the Wacky West by Easterners." So, I don't know how accurate that is, but it's located very close to East Hastings Street, which was Willie Picton's hunting grounds for women fighting addiction battles. When police arrived at the hotel, they found the naked and deceased body of Vanessa Lee Buckner. And Vanessa had very recently lost custody of her newborn child, who had been born dependent on drugs, and Vanessa was known to have been an alcoholic. She was also have known to have been depressed over the loss of her baby girl. And Vanessa had spent the previous evening in the company of Gilbert Paul Elsie, who had witnessed Vanessa get extremely inebriated over the evening, and when she passed out and black liquid started to ooze from her mouth, he hightailed it out of there to leave her to die alone. And Vanessa's blood alcohol was 0.91, which is the equivalent to about 30 ounces of hard liquor in a 12-hour period. Now, according to the Cleveland Clinic, just to kind of give you some perspective on this, obviously 0.0 is sober. At 0.05, you might have some impairment to your alertness and judgment. At 0.15 is usually when you start to throw up. A blood alcohol of between 0.3 and 0.4, you're likely going to have some alcohol poisoning. It's potentially life-threatening. And experience a loss of consciousness, and any blood alcohol over 0.4 is potentially fatal blood alcohol, and you are at risk of coma and death from respiratory arrest, which is the scientific term is absence of breathing. So in other words, fancy pants talks for you're dead. So according to them, you can build a tolerance to the effects of alcohol, but your blood alcohol is the same. So for me, who's not a regular drinker, I could have a couple of drinks and be legally allowed to drive based on my blood alcohol content, but be actually impaired. So just so you know, I don't drink much at all. And when I do, I never drive, like even after one drink. So don't write me letters. I've got good self-awareness about that kind of stuff. But the other side is also true, that someone who's a heavy drinker can have like 5 beers and feel completely sober, but would blow over on a check stop because your blood alcohol content is still over that limit. So just don't drink and drive. But my point is that seasoned alcoholics can be happy and fine 1 minute and then dead the next because their blood alcohol content gets too high without them realizing it. It's the same if you drink too much too fast and don't let the effects of each drink set in. Okay, so with that little lecture out of the way, the police ruled Vanessa's death an accident. She had died by inhaling the gastric contents of her stomach, causing a failure to breathe. But hearing Gilbert's name connected to her made them kind of wonder if there was maybe something a little more sinister going on. On that night before, around 6:30 p.m., Vanessa and Gilbert checked into the Niagara together under Gilbert's name, and they consumed a very large amount of alcohol together. And Gilbert left the room at 6 a.m. to get even more alcohol, and when he returned, he called 911 around 7:40 a.m., Now, when he called police, he didn't give his name, but had actually already left her by the time that he'd called, and they were able to track him down because they traced the call to the Marble Arch Hotel and Strip Club, and because he had checked them in both under his name, Gilbert Elsie. Gilbert had been born Gilbert Paul Elsie in Vancouver on December 12, 1931. He dropped out of high school and was a raging alcoholic. By 1952, he had racked up a pretty good criminal record for things like theft, assault, car thefts, and heroin possession. And by the 1960s, he was drinking on average 50 ounces of vodka every day, saying, "Sober people won't go out with me, so I didn't have much option. I didn't want to drink in my room all by myself." So most of Gilbert's companions and friends were also alcoholics and drug users. He also very much liked the company of sex workers. In 1961, Gilbert was caught with a 5-year-old Aboriginal girl in his car. They were far from the First Nations reserve that was her home. He was charged with her abduction, but he was never convicted due to a stay of proceedings. On Boxing Day, which is the day after Christmas, that same year, he got so drunk that he had threatened to jump from the Lionsgate Bridge and held up traffic for several hours before giving up and then just walking away. At the trial for this, because back in the 1960s, it was a crime to attempt suicide and causing a disturbance to traffic, he got himself in contempt charges for giving the judge a Nazi salute. In 1963, he lured 2 women to his car by offering them booze. He was charged with rape and theft, which he was convicted of on the theft charge, but acquitted on the rape, probably because they'd been asking for it, which is sarcasm, not my actual thoughts, just FYI. Sometime during his various stints in prison, he learned barbering and opened the Slocan Barber Shop on Kingsway Avenue, which is in an area not much or at all better than West Pender. He also inherited some money from a dead relative and invested it in the stock market and made himself rather wealthy. But due to his alcoholism and love of sex workers, he continued to prefer the city's seedier east side. It was no accident that he had his barber shop where it was. It was close to Hastings Street, which had a lot of bars and the kind that he liked to frequent. And according to First Nations Drum Archives, once Hastings leaves the downtown core and reaches the Woodworth's building, the scenery changes drastically as pawn shops and sleazy hotels and abandoned buildings with boarded windows create a seedy backdrop for Vancouver's east side. Bars are everywhere, but the most notorious are on the block of Hastings between Columbia and Main Street. The Sunrise Hotel was often a haven for junkies, and waiters had to sweep up the needles left on the dance floor after the band finished playing. Across the street is Brandy's, where patrons can watch porno movies while they drink. The Pennsylvania, the Regent, the Balmoro were all bars that catered to hardcore drinkers. He also blended in well, being a heavy drinker, but also short, balding with thick glasses made him look pretty harmless to junkies and meth-addicted sex workers. He preferred the company of women that he considered to be on their last legs. So women that were longtime alcoholics that were desperate for free drinks. But what sparked the police's interest in relation to Vanessa's death and the connection to Gilbert was that back in 1965, a switchboard operator named Ivy Rose Oswald had been with Gilbert the night before her nude body was found at another Vancouver hotel with a blood alcohol count of 0.51, which, remember, is the absence of breathing, aka dead. Death by alcohol poisoning generally involves drinking a very large quantity in a short amount of time, and Ivy's death had been ruled an accident as well. Days after the discovery of Ivy's body, Gilbert changed his last name to Jordan. And after he continued under this new name, he racked up more charges, usually for drinking and driving, and in 1969 was actually charged twice in the same day. In 1971, he was charged with committing an indecent act in public, but that charge was dismissed. In 1973, he was convicted of indecent exposure. And in 1974, he was convicted again of indecent assault and got 2 years for that. The Crown tried to have him declared a dangerous offender, but he had money, which afforded him a very good lawyer, so that was denied. And then in 1975, he abducted a woman from a mental health facility, and he was charged with kidnapping, sexual intercourse with a feeble-minded person, which I hope to God is now called something different, and he got just over 2 years again for that crime. And all of that makes Gilbert look like a very not-so-good person. But what's so interesting to them was that women all over East End had been dying of alcohol poisoning in various hotel rooms, which was and still is an endemic in Vancouver's East End, but very often were last seen in the company of Gilbert. On November 30th, the body of Mary Johnson was found at the Elmer Hotel. She had a blood alcohol level of 0.34. On September 11th, 1981, Barbara Paul was found at the Jenard Hotel with a blood alcohol count of 0.41. On July 3rd, 1982, there was another woman, I wasn't able to track down her name. She was found at 2503 Kingsway, which was coincidentally his barber shop. She had a blood alcohol count of 0.76. Like 0.76, just try to process that. December 15th, 1984, Patricia Thomas was also found at his barber shop with a blood alcohol count of 0.51. June 28th, 1952, same barber shop, Patricia Andrew was found with a blood alcohol count of 0.79. Again, shockingly high. And on November 19th, 1986, just a year before Vanessa was found, the body of Vera Harry was found at the Clifton Hotel with a blood alcohol count of 0.4. And 1 month after Vanessa's death, the police were called to another rundown hotel in the East End to collect the body of Edna Shade, who was also found nude. And this time, police found out that she was in the company of Gilbert through fingerprints that were left in the room. So Gilbert was actually put under surveillance to try and figure out what the heck was going on with him. But I just want to conjecture here a bit that had Vanessa Buckner not been a white woman, they might not have bothered looking into him any further. I'm just saying.
Most tax pros leave a message.
It's Jane. I'm moving on to a TurboTax expert who beat your price. Adam Devine, tell him how I feel.
Hey, tax pro, she's been thinking twice. Best believe TurboTax will beat your price. This is a tax break.
Switch to a TurboTax Live expert and we'll beat what you paid your pro last tax season. Make the switch at TurboTax.com/beat your price. TurboTax full service only. Sign up by 12/20/2024 and file by 4/1/2025. Full details at TurboTax.com/beat your price.
And between October 12th and November 26th of 1987, they watched Gilbert as he would cruise around the East End and look for usually a First Nations woman because they are a vulnerable population, and ask them back to a hotel, and usually the women were involved in the sex trade and were offered alcohol. And the police would listen to his conversations in the room with the woman. And this is where things get a little bit muddled. In the court documents, well, here, I'll just read it to you. The accused and the women were under police surveillance in the hotels where they went to drink. The women did not die, perhaps because of police surveillance and involvement. The first two women at the end of the drinking sessions had blood alcohol levels of 0.52 and 0.43. The blood alcohol levels in the third and fourth cases are not known. A police officer gave evidence from notes that he had made, and the trial judge summarized that evidence in this way. While listening outside of a hotel room doors, the accused was heard to say to various women such things as, "Have a drink, down the hatch, baby, $20 if you drink it right down. See, you're a real woman, finish that drink, down the hatch, hurry right down. You need another drink? I'll give you $50 if you can take it. I'll give you $10, $20, $50, whatever you want, come on. I want to see you get it all down. You get it right down. I'll give you the $50 and the $13. I'll give you $50. I told you that. If you finish that, I'll give you $75. Finish your drink, I'll give you $20, just et cetera, et cetera." So my question is, a blood alcohol count of 0.52, and how did the police let it get so bad? And how did they intervene in a way that Gilbert didn't know that he was under surveillance? Anyways, the first woman was Rosemary Wilson on November 20th, whom he took to the Balmoral Hotel. She's the one that had a blood alcohol count of 0.52. Then on the next night, it was Verna Chartrand at the Pacific Hotel. Her blood alcohol was the 0.43. On November 25th, so 4 nights after that, they watched him take Sheila Joe to the Rainbow Hotel and feed her booze for hours. And on the 26th, he took Mabel Olson to the Pacific Hotel. Now, don't get me wrong, I am glad that they intervened and I'm glad that these four women survived. But I'm struggling to understand letting them be bait without their knowledge. I mean, it's kind of like they figured, well, they're First Nations and alcoholics anyway, so we'll try to stop it, but you know, they're going to drink like that anyways. I don't know, the whole thing just feels really icky to me. And also the First Nations drum reported that all four women were unconscious when they were rescued. But also icky is Gilbert's MO here. He's the one that I'm actually really mad at. So what Gilbert was actually charged with was manslaughter, but manslaughter through criminal negligence, which is the legal definition, is that criminal negligence is doing something or admitting to do something, which is the duty of the accused to do, which shows wanton or reckless disregard for the life or safety of Vanessa. And when the Crown indicts for the crime of manslaughter, it does not have to prove the specific intent to kill. It only needs to prove the general intent. So proof of the unlawful act itself is sufficient proof of that general intent. Therefore, proof of negligence, criminal negligence on the part of the accused is sufficient to prove the general intent of Gilbert Paul Jordan, which is necessary for a conviction on the indictment charging manslaughter, which is a lot of blah, blah, blah. So basically, if you commit criminal negligence, like obviously just the fact that you were criminally negligent showed the intent that you knew that something really bad could happen. And Vanessa's father, Nick, said at the trial, "He poisons them first and then has sex with them. No parent should have to go through this. He's a worm. He's a lowlife. He should be squashed just as he squashed a lot of girls' lives." And Gilbert Jordan, as was now his legal name, was convicted of manslaughter, with Justice Bowick stating, "Applying that reasoning to the facts before me, the death of Vanessa Buckner due to the overconsumption of alcohol may be consistent with an innocent intention on the part of the accused Jordan. However, the additional evidence surrounding the death and potential harm to the other 10 women may tend to prove that the facts relating to Vanessa Buckner are consistent only with a guilty intent on the part of the accused to commit the unlawful act of criminal negligence. Notwithstanding the pervasive submissions of Mr. Orris for the accused, the Crown has satisfied me that the similar fact evidence is admissible on the narrow issue of intent. The probative force of their evidence outweighs the risk of an unfair conviction. Although the Crown put forward the similar fact evidence to show the intent of the accused at the time of the death of Vanessa, it now appears on the basis of additional case law supplied to me by counsel that intention is not an essential ingredient in the proof of criminal intent. Intention, while it may be an aggravating feature of criminal negligence, is not an essential element. Indifference in the sense of a negative state of mind will suffice. Thus, the similar fact evidence may also be examined to illustrate the indifference of the accused towards Vanessa. In other words, his indifference in supplying her with too much alcohol illustrates a wanton or reckless disregard for her life or safety. And he was sentenced to 15 years. But then on October 1st, 1991, he filed, or his fancy lawyer that he could afford, filed two appeals. one for the conviction and one for the sentence. And the one about the conviction, his lawyer claimed, well, he appealed on a few different grounds. One was under Section 228 of the Criminal Code that no person commits culpable homicide where he causes the death of a human being by any influence of the mind alone or by any disorder or disease resulting from influence of the mind alone. And the second was that there was no evidence that Gilbert had actually caused Vanessa's death directly. It was argued that the trial judge said that alcohol was her cause of death, or at least a contributing cause of her death, and that he did not consider whether Vanessa voluntarily consumed the alcohol and that her voluntary consumption was a new intervening cause, which put an end to this chain of causation starting with him giving her the alcohol. And the other grounds were a lot of legal blah, 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 and that appeal was denied. As to the sentencing, his grounds for appeal were that the sentence on both counts was unduly harsh and excessive. And in addition, the court didn't grant any pretrial custody time. The court displayed little concern of the treatment programs that he had completed during the 4.5 months waiting trial, including his alcohol treatment. And he was successful in that appeal. So he got the 15 years reduced to 9, which really didn't matter because in the end he actually only served 6. And then he was back on the streets on probation, which restricted him to staying on Vancouver Island. In June 2000, he was charged with sexual assault, negligence causing bodily harm, and administering a noxious substance. And he immediately set about trying to change his name to Paul Pierce, because at the time in BC, you could apply for a name change without giving fingerprints or any kind of criminal background check. So under a new name, he wouldn't have these pesky charges hanging over his head. But that little loophole was shut by the province, and then they changed the law, and Gilbert dropped his application to change his name. So still going by Jordan, he was given only 30 days for those offenses, which seems completely ridiculous to me. But in 2002, he was charged with breach of probation when he was found drinking again, and again in the company of a woman. And for that, he was given another 15 months with 3 years of probation. And in that case, he had invited a First Nations woman to his hotel in Port Renfrew to party and offered her money to stay and drink with him after she tried to leave. In January of 2003, he appealed that sentence, asking for a reduction of his probation period, feeling that the fact that at one point the woman had insisted on leaving, he said, well, then give me back my booze, meant that he had made attempts to correct his error in judgment. There's a couple of interesting things written in that appeal, though. One of them was that the appellate points out in ground that his previous indictable conviction was in 1988. So he's basically claiming, like, but I've been a good boy since 1988. He neglects to mention, however, that he was imprisoned for 6 years after that and was therefore unable to commit any criminal offenses during that time. The appellate says that the attempted breach should not thrust him into the most serious of offenders category. The judge said at that time, I disagree with that. The circumstances of count one replicate the pattern of conduct which led to the manslaughter conviction and the similar fact circumstances admitted as evidence in those proceedings. The manslaughter conviction followed the death of an Aboriginal woman after ingesting an extraordinary amount of alcohol while in the appellate's company. The similar fact evidence was that 10 other Aboriginal women, 6 of whom died, were found to have extraordinary high levels of alcohol after drinking with the appellate. The recognizance in issue here explicitly prohibited the appellate from being in the circumstances out of which the manslaughter conviction arose. The facts that the appellate was not successful in this case in luring the victim into his hotel to drink and the Crown could not prove that she actually consumed any alcohol do not, in my view, detract from the seriousness and dangerousness of the appellate's actions. Anyways, that whole thing was denied and he stayed on his probation and then continued to breach his conditions. In August of 2004, he disappeared from Vancouver, and a Canada-wide warrant was issued for him. He was arrested later in Winnipeg, which is a bit of a distance from Vancouver Island, because word got out that on August 9th, he was binge drinking with a woman named Barb Berkeley at the York Hotel in Swift Current in Saskatchewan. Barb's friend Kathy took her to the hospital after finding she'd passed out, and Kathy said that she remembered Gilbert being there at this party with her. but he was acquitted of those charges, but the police did release a statement to the public. Jordan Gilbert Paul, age 73, is the subject of this alert. Jordan is 175 centimeters or 5'9" tall, weighs about 79 kilograms, 174 pounds. He is partially bald with gray hair and gray goatee. He has blue eyes and wears glasses. Jordan is currently in the Victoria area but has no fixed address. Jordan has a significant criminal record, including manslaughter and indecent assault of a female. He uses alcohol to lure his victims. Jordan's target victim group is adult females. Jordan is subject to Crown-ordered conditions, including abstain absolutely from the consumption of alcohol, not be in the company of any female person or persons in any place where alcohol is either being consumed or possessed by that person or persons. If you observe this subject in violation of any of the above conditions, please call the Saanich Police Department at 475-4321-911 or your local police agency. So 1 year later, on July 7th, 2006, Gilbert Paul Elsie Jordan died of, are you ready for it? This is 50 ounces of vodka a day since the age of 16 to 74. Natural causes. And that was the crimes committed by Gilbert Jordan. This case is usually referred to as the boozing barber if you're looking to research it for more for yourself. But you know how I feel about pet names for cases. And with that, I'm going to be back again next week with another case. As always, thank you so much for listening.
The world of 911 emergency dispatching is brutally diverse. One minute you can be talking with someone about parking violations.
What's the process we are to take to have people towed? Because it's actually delaying the mail.
And then all hell can break loose. Then the rest of the day is crazy. We could have murders.
Hill County 911, what's your emergency?
I just killed my children.
Home invasions.
He's in my house.
I shot him.
You shot him?
He was coming up towards me and I shot him.
Natural disasters.
Tornado came through and got us. I'm buried on the above to roll my life.
Even bombings. My show, Music City 911, will put you in the dispatcher's chair, put you ear to ear with the callers and responders, and keep you on edge from start to finish. I hope to both educate and entertain, as I'm a 911 dispatcher with over 20 years experience. And just like dispatching, every episode is different from the last. Music City 911. Real 911 calls, real 911 dispatchers. Available to listen to on any podcast app.
Most tax pros leave a message.
It's Jane. I'm moving on to a TurboTax expert who beat your price. Adam Devine, tell him how I feel.
Hey, tax pro, she's been thinking twice. Best believe TurboTax will beat your price.
This is a tax break.
Switch to a TurboTax live expert and we'll beat what you paid your pro last tax season. Make the switch at TurboTax.com/beat your price. TurboTax full service only. Sign up by 12/20/2024 and file by 4/1/2025. Full details at TurboTax.com/beat your price.